amount of overlap you could be getting would be so great, and the adhesive thickness is probably a fraction of a thousandth of an inch. You're going to get such a large amount of capacitive coupling through that adhesive with that amount of overlap you'd have with a reasonable spiral wrap. I don't think you could make an inductor that way if you wanted to. So he's got multiple choices. And if I know Paul, he's enough of a scientist, he's going to try a couple of these different wrapping techniques to find out how it works. And Paul, when you do that, come back and let us know how it all works. Let's see if Paul needs any fill before we go over to John, and then we'll be coming back to Paul's second question. WS2N for any fill, K2LIW in the TechNet. You got a great question there, Paul.
Very good, Dick. You know, I like the tape idea. I had that, and mine is probably 3-4 inches wide. It's wide, and I had gotten it from work one time, and then I saw it in the Aid Auto store years ago. Now Aid Auto is in my Montcalm, it's gone, and another auto store has replaced it. So I'm going to go look there and see if they still carry it. But, I do have it. But I think they use it for, you know, temporary things for cars. And originally, I could see where they got the 500-mile-an-hour name from. They used to have, they used to call the tape that racing car, the cars used to use, they used to call 200-mile-an-hour tape. So I guess for the airplanes, they came up with 500. Good answers, guys. And I'm going to go, if you go camping, you know, you could see taking your mag mount that's on your car, you drove there, and instead of leaving it on the car and tripping over it and running the wire to a tent or something, you could stick it next to, onto a tree, lash it to a tree or something, and right next to your tent or a camper. Sounds good. Dick, back to that.
I could think of one step even further. You go to the camping location, you take the 5/8 mag mount that was on the top of the car, if you want to use the same one, you take it off of the automobile, on the top of your piece of tubing, whatever it is, that's got the piece of 500 mile an hour or 200 mile an hour tape going down the side, the top of the tape goes to a metallic plate, which has got an L bend to it, that's screwed into the top of the tubing, and that piece of metal plate is itself magnetic. You then just take your mag mount that normally sticks to the top of the car, you stick it to that metal plate on top of your tubing. It already has the tape connected to that metal plate going down the side, and you're off and running. So the mag mount just goes from automobile to the top of your tubing with that metal plate with the L bracket, if you see what I mean. You get the picture, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet.
You read my mind, Dick. I mean, cooking tins I've got laying around. You take a small cup on the thing. Just to take the kind of poise, but helps. Hope that'll be attached to the peeps. Good going. WS2N.
Okay, sounds like you're going to have fun with that one. Come back and let us know how it works. John, KC2WGB. You normally are giving us information. How in the world do you have a question? You got it, John. K2LIW.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick. Paul. Everyone on the net. I figured I'd write my own question in here and ask the geniuses here. I have a question on a bird watt meter. Do you have any idea what we could calculate for the insertion loss of a bird watt meter? Would you say it's around a tenth of a dB? What do you think, Dick?
Darn good question, and there's a zillion different answers. The bird watt meter has a straight through section of a very large center conductor, a very large outer conductor. It's got a hole in one side, so to speak, where you plug in the plug. The plug, on the plug, you'll see it's rated for 5,000 watts, 1,000 watts, 100 watts, 1 watt, and the plug itself is a directional coupler. That directional coupler has its own internal little termination, and there's a constant amount of power that the directional coupler has to send after rectification to the Dawson Bell movement, the actual indicator on the front panel. So let me pick a number out requires 10 milliwatts of power to deflect that meter. It's in the right ballpark. When you're running the kilowatt slug, which means that it only needs 10 milliwatts of power, so it's probably a 40 decibel directional coupler, 40 decibels difference between the power flowing down the center of the bird watt meter and what goes into the slug. Only 10 milliwatts is being sucked out of a kilowatt. You will never be able to measure that insertion loss. Correspondingly, if you're running the 100 milliwatt slug, that you make one, and you still need the same 10 milliwatts in order to run your Dawson valve movement, on that case, the 100 milliwatt slug, when you plug it into your bird watt meter, is going to have a half a dB of insertion loss. Conservation of energy. So how much energy is flowing down the center of the line, and you're continuously drawing out 10 milliwatts in my example. So what's the insertion loss of the bird watt meter? It can be anything from 0.001 all the way up to half a dB.
Repeater, timeout.
As I was starting to say, all the way up to half a dB, depending on which slug you're using, which really is what power level you're running through the machine, because you're always taking out the same amount of power to run the meter. Does that make a little more sense, John? KC2 WGB, K2LIW in the tech net.
Oh, absolutely, Dick. No, that sounds correct. Just wanted to know, also, the other meter goes, let's see if I can remember. Oh, fucking old. There's a half a dB. Is it also dependent on frequency? Let's say from 100 megacycles to 1 gig, what do you think that insertion loss would vary?
Okay, if the slug is rated for the frequency range where you're using it, then by way of the calibration procedure, if, for instance, it needs 10 milliwatts to run its meter throughout that whole 100 megs to 1,000, that whole frequency region, it is continuously taking out exactly 100 milliwatts. The way it does that is it's got a fancy circuit in there that ordinarily when you build a directional coupler and you build it too small, in other words, the directional coupler, in the ideal world, the coupled line wants to be a quarter of a wavelength long. Well, a quarter wavelength long at most of those frequencies is a lot bigger than the diameter of your slug. Let me drop. So therefore, because it is less than a quarter wavelength long, the real pickup loop of the directional coupler is falling off at 6 dB per octave as you go down in frequency. However, they have put a circuit in there, which is a kind of a low-pass filter, which goes up at 6 dB per octave. So the combination of that low-pass circuit filter built into the slug plus the less than quarter wavelength long coupling loop means that throughout its rated frequency range, if 10 milliwatts is the number it sucks out, it is continuously sucking out 10 milliwatts. Now, ordinary type N connectors and feed-through networks and whatever, let me drop, will have a little bit more insertion loss at 1 gig than they do at 100 megs. So there's another factor coming in of just the basic hardware itself. But I think the real insertion loss of a bird watt meter, except for the very low power level slugs that you might be using in your particular case, ordinarily the insertion loss is so darn small, as I said, it's something in the vicinity of a constant 10 milliwatts is my guess. And so what is 10 milliwatts compared to the power level you're running? 10 milliwatts compared to a kilowatt ain't nothing. 10 milliwatts compared to 100 milliwatts, yeah, that's something in the vicinity of half a dB. I think that's the dominant factor, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense to me too. All right, just thought I'd fill that data in because I was totally at a loss to visualize that loss of how many dB it would be. I figured it'd be about a tenth of a dB, somewhere around there. But of course, according to the slug, always having to deliver the full-scale voltage to make the meter move, there's the calculation. Okay, let me let it drop it more for the next one.
Yeah, Wes, I know you wanted to make some comments.
camping question.
Very fine, Paul. Now we'll go over to the mailbag. And those really wild thinking guys that mail you all these crazy questions, John, these are not good questions in physics. What have you received this week? KC2WGB with the mail guy. Here we go. Mailbag, K2RIW and the Tech Man.
Okay, Dick. Well, the first one is a gentleman that has very little funding, and he'd like to get into reception of 1 to 5 gig. And the receivers, even the stuff he sees on eBay that cover those frequencies, very expensive. What would you recommend that he can make himself or assemble from parts that he'd be able to do something like that? I don't know what type of antenna he thinks he's going to use, but maybe you can just cover real quick from antenna to speaker.
That's a fairly tough one, John. The guys who do serious microwave work almost always do it with a so-called transverter. A transverter, say for instance I was on 1296, the transverter would consist of an 1152 fixed crystal controlled oscillator mixed with the 1296 coming in. The difference in frequency is 144. The 144 tunable IF, when you tune your IF from 144 to 148 with a typical all-mode rig, ham radio rig, you're tuning 1296 to 1296.4, 1300 is where you tune. So to tune a few megahertz of particular ham bands with a tunable IF fixed LO type transverter, fairly easy to build, very popular designs. You Google those words and no problem. However, if I want continuous coverage, not individual sections of a ham band, continuous coverage from 1 to 5 gigs, life gets a lot more complicated. When it comes to scanners, you take, for instance, your ICOM R7000. Yeah, it tunes 25 megs to 2 gigs inclusive. So at least the 1 to 2 gig region on that scanner type receiver will give it to you. But 1 to 5, I don't think anybody builds a scanner that tunes 1 to 5. Let me drop. However, there is a kind of scanner. Any spectrum analyzer. You buy a spectrum analyzer that tunes whatever frequency up to 3 or 5 gigs or 8 gigs. It is a receiver. So a spectrum analyzer, and there have been articles in the QEX, the Experimenters Exchange of ARRL, showing you how to take the assembly that goes in the front end of a television set, the tunable converter section of the front end that allows you to tune across the UHF frequencies, so to speak, and convert that into a poor man's spectrum analyzer. Unfortunately, it doesn't cover that frequency range. So by one means or another, if you get a hold of a beat-up spectrum analyzer that covers the frequency range you want to cover, as a receiver, it'll work like a charm, and it's calibrated. In frequency, it's calibrated in amplitude, but there's a catch. Let me drop. In the case of a spectrum analyzer, you usually want to make quantitative measurements. You want to know that when you tune it to 1296.5, that within a small number of kilohertz, it's on that frequency. And when you measure off the screen a signal to level of minus 10 dBm, within a dB or so, it measures that amplitude. So spectrum analyzers give you quantitative data at frequency, quantitative data of amplitude, and by way of usually selectable IFs, you can know what the signal-to-noise ratio is, depending on whether you're using the 1 meg IF, the 100 kc IF, the 10 kc resolution bandwidth IF filter. You usually have selectable filters in the front panel. So as you can see, as a receiver connected to an antenna, a spectrum analyzer is beautiful. There's one catch. In order to make a spectrum analyzer flat, in order to make it equally responsive to a signal at 500 megs or 5 gigs, for a whole bunch of reasons, they usually have a lot of insertion loss in the front end, and therefore they typically have 30 decibel noise figure. So as a receiver, beautiful in quantity of frequency and amplitude, terrible in sensitivity, but there's a solution. Good job. recognize that a spectrum analyzer does everything you want, except it doesn't have natural sensitivity. But now that you recognize the fact that most of them start off with approximately 30 decibel of noise figure, and if you're smart enough to put a 30 decibel gain preamplifier in front of it, you've got everything. And nowadays, picking up an MGF-1402 transistor, for instance, and building a low noise preamplifier that has 20 dB of gain in one single stage and less than 1 dB of noise figure in that stage, to homebrew that preamplifier, or to buy it, but to homebrew it, it's got $15 worth of parts, if you know what I mean. So by adding preamplifiers in front of a spectrum analyzer, you've got it all. It's now not a poor man's scanner, and that's a medium-rich man's scanner as far as the quantitative data of frequency and amplitude you get off that screen. There are, from time to time, beat-up spectrum analyzers sold on the surplus market, sometimes for fairly nice prices, sometimes cheaper than a scanner receiver occasionally. So that's a possible approach. But to go out and buy a scanner from 1 to 5 gigs, I believe it almost doesn't exist. Drag your feet a little bit when I send it back to you, John, in case somebody does know of a 1 to 5 gig scanner that's on the shelf somewhere of some brand name. KC2WGB with some delay. K2LIW on the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Okay, yeah, I have a 1 to 4 gig scanner, and kind of pricey. Works very well. But I was wondering, could he get something that would cover that range from, like, microcircuits or that company that assembles microwave products and use a down converter to his ham rig? Is something like that possible?
Yes, it is. If we now do it backwards, the average ham radio operator building a transverter, he wants to know that when his tunable IF is set at 144.0, he wants to know if the signal coming out is 1296.0. He wants frequency accuracy of the translating function. Therefore, he uses a crystal-controlled oscillator at 1152 megahertz based on 100 meg crystal fifth overtone or something like that. You could do it backwards. Rather than a crystal-controlled local oscillator, you build the exact same circuit, unplug the crystal-controlled oscillator, and plug in a voltage-controlled oscillator that scans from 1 to 5 gigs. So you can do it backwards. Instead of scanning the IF, the so-called tunable IF approach, scan the local oscillator. You'll lose some of the frequency accuracy, because to build a voltage-controlled oscillator that scans from 1 to 5 gigs, not too difficult. Unfortunately, though, whatever voltage you plug into it, you plug into a voltage that's supposed to give you 3.0 gigs out of your voltage-controlled oscillator, and you really get 3.1 gigs. That sounds like it's an acceptable error. Well, I just described 100 megahertz of error in what frequency you think you're tuned to versus what frequency you really are. And now a smarter guy will combine that with another piece of surplus equipment. Let me drop. A smarter guy will take that slightly sloppy voltage-controlled oscillator, which, by the way, could be home-brewed with $10 worth of parts. And now, the output of the voltage-controlled oscillator that operates that scanning mixer front-end down converter, so to speak, he has a sampling port on that thing, which goes into a frequency counter. So that now, while he's scanning at whatever frequency he cares about with his voltage-controlled oscillator to tune his converter system to, let's say, 3.25 gigahertz, if he's measuring the oscillator output on a frequency counter, he's now got it all. Now, except for a little bit of translation of what the scale of the frequency counter reads, he now knows where he is. He's got a little bit of an ambiguity problem of the plus and minus IF. In other words, if he's using a 144 meg, let me drop. He's using a 144 meg tunable IF, so to speak, and he's leaving it fixed. And he now knows that He knows exactly what frequency the oscillator is on, and the signal he's hearing, our F-wise, is at 144 megs higher than the local oscillator, or 144 megs lower than the oscillator. He's got a little bit of an ambiguity there. And there's various ways he can resolve that. The next level of sophistication would be to have a tunable filter, a tracking filter, that works with the voltage-controlled oscillator. I'm not recommending that. I'd rather live with the image and real problem and use some other method. In fact, all you'd have to do is swish the local oscillator. The first time you find the RF signal, the oscillator is going to be on the low side. The second time you find that RF signal, the oscillator is going to be on the high side. So you know what direction you're rotating the dial on your voltage-controlled oscillator, and you know that the response you just got is either the first response or the second response. Therefore, you know the RF is on the high side or the low side of the LO. I'd much rather do that than to try to build a tracking voltage-controlled filter from 1 to 5 gigahertz. That in itself, you could spend a lot of time trying to perfect that circuit. I'm not recommending that. So I think you see the process here, John. KC2WGB, K2RYW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. Yeah, I think there's several ways he could go, and maybe if he called Down East Microwave or one of those companies, maybe they could give him a heads up. But I like the idea of using a spectrum analyzer and a preamp. Yeah. That, and he can get a decent spectrum analyzer for $200, somewhere around that. And from what I understand, he's not that interested in frequency. I think he just wants to be able to hear the spectrum between 1 and 5 gig. Doesn't have to know exactly what he's on. Maybe he'll get to that later. But, yeah, some good points. Let me let it drop. I'll give it a pause, and I'll go on to the next one.
Yeah, let me give you a couple of words on spectrum analyzer. In approximately 1971, I'm working for Edwin Instruments Laboratory, and I'm one of the engineers on the development of the AIL-707 spectrum analyzer, which ran from roughly 0 to 12.4 gigahertz in its original version. And there was a later version that went to 20 gigs. Okay? There were a couple of military services that wanted to have a 0 to 12.4 gigahertz receiver for wartime application. They bought from us spectrum analyzers. Those spectrum analyzers were sent to Vietnam to various military bases. Antennas were connected to them. And the spectrum analyzer was then used to tune across that frequency range to listen for signals of interest to that military organization. And so occasionally we would receive a spectrum analyzer back for repair, and we could tell by the bugs inside that it had been in Vietnam in a jungle somewhere. Occasionally they would come back with a whole lot of damage because of salt water spray, because they came back strapped to the deck of a ship. And the salt water was washing over the deck of the ship while this thing came back to us. Those were, of course, essentially unrepairable. So using a spectrum analyzer as a broadband quantitative receiver for surveillance work works like a charm. It's been done lots of times in history, because for them to buy a piece of military electronics, let me drop, and have it delivered in a short period of time for the Vietnam War, which, by the way, we call it the Vietnam War. The people in North Vietnam call it the American War. There's a whole lot of fun you can have with that one. Anyhow, using a spectrum analyzer as a receiver is a beautiful thing to do. I think they were using the receiver barefoot, but there's a chance that they already bought from somebody else a set of preamplifiers they plugged in front of it to lower its 30 decibel natural noise figure. So spectrum analyzers as quantitative surveillance reconnaissance receivers for wartime application. Oh, there's a whole lot of history of that one, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, Dick, I know I found a lot of things sweeping through with my spectrum analyzers when they were hooked up to antennas. There's some interesting things out there. Some very strange signals. Couldn't figure out a lot of them, what they were. But you will see them all. You'll see radar pulses, all kinds of pulse signals going out. Interesting stuff. All right, let me let it drop, and I'll go on to the next one. I'll let it drop for a while in case somebody wants to come in.
By the way, John, you live on Todd Hill, one of the high locations in Staten Island, one of the five boroughs of New York City. Arguably, New York City is the hottest RF piece of real estate on planet Earth. If you're within a small number of miles of the Empire State Building, what will eventually becoming the replacement for the World Trade Center, the so-called Freedom Tower, RF-wise, you are in a very hot environment. So you take a scannable receiver that tunes any frequency region where you live. You're going to find lots of stuff. In fact, all you've got to do, John, is to wet your finger, put it up in the air outside of your house, and the RF hitting your finger, if you've got a sensitive on the finger, you're going to feel the heat. I'm having some fun with you. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, Dick, we can pop popcorn on a coffee table without a cell phone. That's how bad it is here.
I kind of thought so, John. You ought to put some popcorn on the table, on your picnic table in the backyard, set up your movie camera, find out how long it takes to pop the popcorn, and you'll know whether or not the cell phones are in full use. In fact, as the local cell site at drive time has a whole lot of people calling their wife, the wife's calling them in the car as they're coming home saying, pick up a loaf of bread and a quart of milk. So with all of those cell phone calls being made, all of that RF going across your picnic table in your backyard is going to be popping the popcorn. That's obvious. Go take a picture of that. It would be fun. If anybody listen to me, we're pulling your leg. KC2WGB, K2LAW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yeah, Dick, they have a lot of fun on YouTube, and people don't really pay attention to what they're watching sometimes, and they get fooled. I agree with you there. Okay, next one's an antenna question. Let me let it drop. Okay, I have a gentleman that has three antennas now existing. These are only for reception, and they're multi-band. He's going to put a coupling unit, a combiner unit, which will have six ports up on the mast. Eventually, he wants to have six antennas. Right now, he only has three. And then he's going to have one coax cable coming down into the shack to his receivers and have a divider, which will have six ports also. His question is, the three ports that are idle, does he have to put terminators on there or just blank caps? What should he do, and how do you think that's going to perform for him? All three antennas that he has now are different spectrum. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, there's a lot of things going on at once there, John. The easiest way to build a six-port divider or summer up at the top of the mast with one piece of coax coming down is the right assemblage of quarter-watt resistors. So with the right assemblage of resistors, I could build for you a 6-to-1 power summing device coming down to one piece of cable. And in the shack, we have another one of those 6-to-1 power summers used backwards, which now takes the one piece of coax, divides it into six separate signals, and it goes to six separate receivers. That's one way of doing it. Quick and dirty. As far as frequency response is concerned, that could be very wide band. That's the good news. The bad news of doing it that way is that your 6-to-1 power divider is going to have something in the vicinity of 7 decibels of insertion loss, maybe closer to 10 dB of insertion loss. Each individual 6-to-1 power divider is going to be close to 10 dB insertion loss. So you're going to have 10 dB of insertion loss at the top of the mast, and whether or not you put caps on those three unused ports is a very minor perturbation. And the same thing with the another 10 dB of loss in the shack with the other resistive 6-to-1 power divider. You're now roughly 20 decibels down because of insertion loss. It's the equivalent of adding 20 decibels more to whatever noise figure the individual receivers in the shack have. If the receiver in the shack has got a 6 decibel noise figure and you've got a pair of 10 decibel attenuators in front of it, 10 plus 10 is 20 plus 6 of the receiver, you have a 26 dB noise figure receiver. When you're in a come into New York City where you live, where all the signals are pretty strong, knocking every one of those signals 26 dB down, no problem. You still got a lot of signals to look at. If you're in the hinterlands, where you're far away from metro centers, but yet you want to get those signals from the metro centers, and the signals are now weak, and you're taking a 26 dB hit, that's going to be hard to sacrifice. It's going to be hard to tolerate. It's going to be a fairly dead receiver, fairly insensitive receiver. So the quick and dirty technique of simple resistive power divider solves the problem in a hurry, puts you on the air, but put in the back of your head that someday downrange, you want to do something about the sensitivity. One step of improvement in the sensitivity would be to put a preamplifier in that coax cable coming down from the mast. You've still got the 10 dB loss at the top of the mast, but with a properly designed preamplifier, it now overcomes the insertion loss of the 10 dB of the power divider in the shack, overcomes the 6 dB of noise figure of the receiver, and you can now bring that system down. See, 10 plus 6, it had 16, and you could knock off 15 dB of that sensitivity by putting in a preamplifier. You can improve the sensitivity by 15 dB by putting a line-driving preamplifier on that coax cable. Let me drop. The next level of improvement on the system would be to have individual preamplifiers at each individual antenna on top of the mast. If each individual antenna had a preamplifier going into that resistive power divider coming down to the one piece of cable, and if there's enough gain of those preamplifiers, that solves the problem. Another approach is to use a multiplexer filter network. I didn't say it's easy, but no, it's possible to build a filter combiner network for that 6-to-1 power divider at the top of the mast, where, let's assume that each of those antennas cover 1 gigahertz. One antenna covers 1 to 2, one antenna covers 2 to 3, one antenna covers 3 to 4, and so on. It is possible to devise a multiplexer filter, which when you feed it backwards, you feed it from the coax cable up, signals from 1 to 2 come out of port number 1, take signals from 2 to 3 gigahertz, come out of port number 2, and so on. By having a multiplexer filter, it's possible for the insertion loss of the 6-to-1 power divider, instead of being 10 dB of loss, to go down a half a dB of loss at each of those frequency regions. But it's a much more complicated network. So as you can tell, multiplexing filters at the top end and the bottom end would be a beautiful way of doing it thoroughly passively. The next level of improvement would be a line-driving preamp on the resistor dividers and a line-driving preamp on the one piece of coax. Now, another level of improvement would be individual preamps on the individual antennas. There's a lot of ways to go, and as you can tell, it's one of these situations where there's a lot of compromises of dollars versus performance. Let me drop. So, you basically pays your money and you takes your choice as to how much you're willing to invest in multiplexing filtering, how much you're willing to invest in individual preamplifiers, how much you're willing to invest on the one single broadband amplifier in the cable. Lots of different ways to go. I think I heard somebody who wanted to make a comment on this. Who was that? K2RIW in the TechNet.
And why just wanted to make the comment.
Okay, I heard NY. I'm going to guess it was NY2HF. Go right ahead, Dennis. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Vic, I just wanted to say that on the southern repeater, you were going in and out, so we didn't get the full width of what you were saying. So, I don't know how you can correct that, but it was going in and out. It wasn't coming in continuous. Back to net.
Very fine, Dennis. What's going on is that the questioner number 2 of the mailbag that John had is a man who's got 6 individual antennas on the top of the mast. He has some kind of a 6-to-1 power divider on the top of the mast with one piece of cable coming down. In the shack, he's got a 6-to-1 power divider again going into 6 separate receivers. His original question was that if for the time being, he's got 3 unused ports on the top of the mast and 3 unused ports on the bottom in the shack, should they be terminated with 50-ohm resistors. And that's a minor detail. There's a much bigger detail in the original design of the system. Any reasonable resistor divider network, 6-to-1 on the top of the mast, is going to have something close to 10 dB insertion loss. Let me drop. And the 6-to-1 divider in the shack, which splits up to the one piece of cable to the six separate receivers, another 10 dB of insertion loss. So depending on how you design the system, you could start off with 20 dB of loss in front of the first receiver in the shack, and that's a particularly big hit when it comes to desensitizing your receiver system. John wouldn't care very much about that because he lives in the hot RF world of one of the five boroughs of New York City, and all the signals near him are strong, and he could take a 20 dB hit, and he's still got a lot of signals to look at. But for a guy in the hinterland, knowing that his receiver is 20 dB down in potential sensitivity before he does the right kind of filtering or the right kind of preamplification networks added. Let me drop. He'd like to know ahead of time what disadvantage you're suffering so that at some later time, when he's got more money in his pocket and he wants to start improving the system, he can either make it a multiplexing filter, both on top of the mast and the one in the shack, and or add preamplifiers in the right sense. When you study the so-called cascaded noise figure formula, where if you know from the antenna how much loss and gain you've got in your individual boxes between the antenna and the final receiver in the shack, you add up all of those mixer insertion loss and the 4-to-1 or 6-to-1 power divider insertion losses and so on. The noise figure builds up, the sensitivity goes down, and it is calculatable so that you can boil this whole problem down to how much performance are you going to get versus how many dollars you spend or how many man hours you're going to spend building preamplifiers to correct it. And so for a crafty guy who is willing to build gas-fed preamplifiers at, let me pick a number, $10 a piece, if he's mass-producing them, he can pretty quick come up with a pretty nice solution to this simplified system. That's one possible approach. There's a lot going on here, as you can tell, John. Let me drop. Craig? Go right ahead, Eric.
Good comment.
Yeah, I need to stop you for a second. John, KG2WDV, I would like you to listen to that frequency that you couldn't hear the last night and tell me what you hear.
Okay, Eric, I have it tuned. All I have is noise right now. That's 928.
It could be 278. And of course you won't hear anything unless someone is talking.
Do you want me to talk, or you said you're going to drop it while you do something?
Well, John, you could talk and listen at the same time.
Or I could do some talking, and that is, so whenever you're setting up multiple antennas going into some kind of a network at the top of the tower, coming down to one piece of cable, another approach is that rarely does a guy listen to every one of those six frequency regions simultaneously. So a set of relays at the top of the tower, one piece of coax cable going up to a series of relays. One approach would be a 6-to-1, a single pole, 6-throw coaxial RF relay at the top of the tower, or an assemblage of individual single pole, double throw relays. So RF relays at the top of the tower, selecting the right antenna at the right time, and a similar set of relays in the shack, selecting the right receiver, is a very high performance workable approach, because on rare occasions, it's only a rare guy that wants to listen to all six frequency regions simultaneously. The average guy is willing to listen to one of them at a time. As you can tell, there's a lot of ways to skin the cat on this one, John. KC2WGB, with any delay where Eric wants to say something, K2RIW in the TechNet.
NY2HF to comment also.
Eric, I am hearing the signal. It's in the noise, but I can understand clearly. I was listening to Dick. And it's working well.
Good. Dick, do me a favor. Go in through 375 for a minute.
now going to a high gain antenna, aim to the west. KE2EJ, K2RIW. Dennis, we'll get to you in a minute. Eric, you got it?
Didn't hear him on that frequency.
Okay. Tell me if you had any delay between the two different repeaters now.
I heard zero delay. I'm hearing myself come back on 8.5. There is no latency at all, Eric. Go ahead.
All right. Problem I was having yesterday, which turns out to be a bad piece of cable.
Dick, I'm hearing about a half a second delay.
Now I'm confused because I'm listening with my earphones on 8.5 on receiver number 2. I was transmitting with transmitter number 1 on 3.75, and there was no delay. I go into a stuttering mode when I hear a delay. I heard no delay, John, so that's confusing. Over to you, John.
There should be no delay, John.
This is Lou. There's no delay here at Port Jeff either. They're spot on.
You got it, Eric.
Alright, I got to run out to Sheldon. I wound up detuning the receiver out there because I was getting so little signal. So, I'm finished at this end. I'm going to go to that end and somebody's going to pay for my gas because it's getting ridiculous.
Hey, Eric, good thing you're dedicated. Good thing you're a rich man. I'm having some fun with him. Dennis, NY2HF, what would you like to add to all this? And I know that the signal is fading out to you. I wonder if it's propagation on 375, so to speak. NY2HF, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Staten Island, Pops Popcorn. We have whole cows due to Plum Island frying in the peels.
Is that what's doing this? Go ahead, Dennis.
I don't know if you copied that. Well, John has popcorn popping in Staten Island from the RF from New York City. We have whole cows flying in the fields from Plum Island.
Okay, so you've probably driven your boat over to Plum Island. You've documented this. You've made a movie of it. I think you should be putting it on YouTube video there, Dennis. And how many cows... And by the way, are the cows that are further to the south, do they cook a little bit faster? NY2HF, K2RIW in the TechNet?
No, actually, Dick, no, I never drove my boat near Plum Island. There was one report of one guy driving his boat near Plum Island. His dog jumped off, and he shot his dog. No. I actually went on Plum Island. I took a tour. I talked to the scientist, and it was really interesting, and I would tell everybody who has the opportunity to do it. It's really, really interesting. But, matter of fact, they just found mammoth bones buried on part of the island, so they want to conserve part of it when it gets decommissioned.
Yeah, give us a couple of words on that one, Dennis. I didn't know that Plum Island was still an active research facility. Sounds like what you just said. It's slated for a close down at some time in the near future. And I think you're saying research is still proceeding there at this time. NY2HF, K2RIW in the TechNet.
All right, Vic, I had a disconnect. I'll be back in a minute.
Okay, so Dennis will be back in a minute. We've had to disconnect him. I think you're saying you disconnected. Let me see.
Yeah, I disconnected 375. I got to take my stuff out of line so I can get out of here.
I can add a couple of comments on the subject we were discussing here, Dick.
He's talking to us on 375 right now.
You don't hear anything on 375, right?
He's talking on 375 right now. He's not coming out of 8.5.
At 8.5, it's not coming out of 375. And once I finish moving these coax cables, then I can turn the transmitter back on.
So I think you're saying that in the next few minutes, you might have the system bidirectionally operating out there. Is that what you're saying, Eric?
Put the AC down and move these wires.
Okay, we'll stand by for, you tell us when, and I'll tell Dennis to repeat what he just told to us, because he's in the dark right now. He just gave us about a two-minute conversation with lots of good data.
R-I-C, Rick.
Okay, in the meantime, we'll pick up the breaking station. Breaking station, give us your call letters and name, and go right ahead and proceed with your comment. K2RIW, check net, my name is Dick.
Hey, how do I get a question to you guys on to get answered?
The right way to do it is to sign in at 8 o'clock at the beginning, and we take those answers in order. We'll make an exception in this case. What's your call letters and name, sir? Go right ahead, K2RIW.
Oh, I apologize, guys, for coming in at the wrong time. I'm a brand new ham here, and I didn't realize that this net started at 8 o'clock. My question is, I have an HF antenna at the back of my vehicle. I have a great big four-door Ford truck, and in the front of the antenna, I have a VHF antenna, or a dual band antenna. I've had problems with static. If I use one style of my if I change my VHF antenna to a mono band, 5/8 with a very long width, almost 4 feet long, why do I get static from it on my HF rig? Or when I changed it to a Comet dual band, very wide banded antenna, I do not get a static on my HF rig.
Sir, you misunderstood me. I asked you to give me your call letters and name so I can add you to the list. We have a subject on the table right now that's being discussed, and I shouldn't interrupt that one. Please at least tell me your call letters and name. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
RIW, VE4RIC, first name, Rick.
Okay. Victor Echo 4, Romeo India Charlie, Rick. K2RIW. You're on the list, Rick. It's going to take us 20 minutes to get to you. Let's see if okay. Looks like we've got the link operational again. As you know, Dennis, some operation on the link is taking place, and therefore you were giving us a beautiful answer about what takes place at Plum Island. And I was hearing you on 375. Unfortunately, it wasn't coming through on 85, and vice versa. Eric has restored that link. You're now back in operation, so please repeat what you told us about Plum Island. NY2HF, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. NY2HF. Plum Island is about 870 acres of research facility that once was a Civil War outpost, which has tunnels running through it. They recently discovered mammoth bones on one southeasterly corner of the island. So it's become something of historical significance. The research lab that's there is actually a level 5 biohazard. Even though that I think they only say it's a 3, but it's far above that. They were talking about building another research facility in Kansas City. Manhattan, Kansas City, I think it was. But they haven't got the funding for that. Let me drop for a second. But so it looks like this might go on for a while, but the township that I live in has been rezoning the island for when the federal government hands it back to the state, which is going to hand it back to the local municipality. And they're going to keep part of it as a research and part of it as conservation. It's actually a beautiful island where harbor seals snuggle up on the rocks and you can see them. You know, it's one of the few places that's pretty pristine at the time. Back to you, Dick.
Township, which I think you're saying, maybe you're telling me it has control of Plum Island, and therefore living in that township, you know a lot about what more is going on, and I suspect that you have also visited it, and maybe on your private craft, or maybe by some other means. And level 5, biohazard. Okay, sounds like they're still doing active research out there and finding these mammoth bones, among other things. When you land your private craft on Plum Island, I'm guessing the first thing you see is a sign giving you warning that you're going into a restricted area. Is that somewhat true, Dennis? NY2HF, K2LIW in the TechNet?
Yes, Dick, that's actually true, but I've never landed my private craft on Plum Island because I didn't want to leave any of my pets or family members behind. There was a story of a boater who came too close to Plum Island and his dog jumped off onto the shore. Well, the security forces that were there shot the dog because one of the mottos of Plum Island is anything that goes there never leaves there. The buses that they use to give you tours on Plum Island are really old bluebirds. And when they said, when they finally, you know, do away with them, they actually buried them because they don't know what the contagions would be that would be on them. I actually took a tour. Let me drop.
And by the way, do you go there by ferry boat, wait for the drop, and go ahead, Dennis?
Yes, I actually took the ferry, the Plum Island ferry, across and took the tour with the scientists and everything else. It was really an important and illuminative discussion. But you know, what I was trying to say was, you can't just bring an animal over there and expect it to leave. There's been reports of helicopters shooting deer that swam across from Orient Point to Plum Island. So, you know, there's nasties over there, and they have to, you know, deal with that. Back to you, Matt.
Thank you. Interesting information. Most of us don't know about it. To your knowledge, most of the people in the town of South Hold or South Hold Township are reasonably familiar with things like you just told us about Plum Island. Is that somewhat true, Dennis? Go ahead.
No, actually, Dick, I wish it was, but...
I heard you say, I wish it was, but I'm not quite sure what you were about to say, Dennis. Go ahead.
Sorry, Dick, I got it on the dual band, so I got broken by the repeater message. What I was going to say is, no, actually, you know, most people are unaware of what's in their surrounding areas. I'm not saying that Plum Island is actually a danger if they, you know, keep to the protocols that they have. I'm just saying that a lot of people are unaware, you know, just like nuclear plants or anything else. You know, they're just not aware. They just go about their day. But a lot of people, quite a few people who are enlightened, you know, actually watch it and have been there and saw it up close and can say that, you know, they're doing a pretty good job. They could do better, you know, and if it has to stay, they should actually safeguard themselves much more than they have been. Back to you, Ned.
I thank you, Dennis. Good information about something we don't know about. And Plum Island has been out there off the tip of the northern fork of Long Island, been there for a lot of years. And the average citizen on Long Island knows very little bit about it. Even the people in your township don't seem to know a whole lot about it. And for people who don't live on Long Island, I have almost all of my life. And you can have a lot of fun with the people who live here. 2.5 million people live here. You can ask almost any one of them, how often do you get over to the mainland? And they'll look at you funny. I'm on the mainland. To them, the island is Fire Island, which is the barrier beach on the south shore of Long Island. But the island itself is 120 miles long and about 35 or 40 miles wide, and almost all the residents there, they think they're on the mainland until they have to go through one of the bridges or tunnels of New York City to really get over to the rest of the United States. Then they suddenly realize they're really on an island. Okay, John, I know we got pretty far left of center. Let me drop. We got pretty far left of center of your original question, but if I was in his shoes, the quickest way to get high performance and yet have six antennas coming down to one piece of cable, in my opinion, would be a setup of RF coaxial relays at the top of the tower. And you give the commands to the relays, which connect whichever antenna you desire at that time to that one piece of cable. Now, the next level of sophistication would be having six pieces of cables from the six antennas coming down the tower. And similarly, six pieces of cable going to six receivers, or a setup of relays in the shack would do it with high performance. But when you start using 6-to-1 power dividers, lots of people don't realize that by the laws of conservation of energy, a 6-to-1 power divider, even though you're using it backwards and you think it's a summer, it still is a power divider, and it's going to have significant insertion loss. And you start adding a lot of loss at the top of the tower, 10 dB worth, a lot of loss in the shack, 10 dB worth, to have these 6-to-1 power dividers going to the six receivers. Sensitivity of your receivers concerned, you're going to take a pretty big hit, a 20 dB hit in that example I just gave you. And maybe it's 17.5 or 19 dB, but it's a lot of dBs. And to knock down the sensitivity of a receiver that much, if you live in a metro area, you might think, well, there's enough to listen to, but you don't really know what you're missing, if you know what I mean. Maybe that's helpful information to your writer, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Okay, well, in order to close this out, what I think he should do, the distance of the single run is 150 feet, Dick. That's why he didn't want to use six cables. A lot of work and ugly. So what I think he should do, being that you want to try to get as much gain up front as you can, is put maybe six 30 dB amplifiers before that first combiner, and then that should clear up any of the errors you should have, including the loss in the cable. What do you think of that?
When it comes to sensitivity, that's a good approach. But there's always conservation of misery, John. As you add six individual preamplifiers of 30 dB gain each, if some of those signals you're listening to happen to be coming from some transmitter that's 1.5 miles away from your house, and therefore it's a super strong signal, which is now going to overload your preamplifier, and that overloaded preamplifier is going to be generating harmonic frequencies. So occasionally you're going to be getting some crazy mixtures of frequencies coming down that cable, which could give you some peculiar responses. So if there is a single broadcast station nearby overloading one or more of those preamplifiers without the right kind of a filter,